Hi, I'm Daniel Dresner. I'm a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I blog at foreignpolicy.com, and I am the author of Theories of International Politics and Zombies.
Hi, I'm Adam Weinstein. I'm an editor at Mother Jones, specializing in national security and international relations.
And with that, I believe we're here to talk about me, which is one of my just favorite topics. No, we're here to talk about theories of international politics and zombies. Adam, you were kind enough to write a review for Mother Jones magazine. A couple of other reviews have come out. Let me start by just offering a brief précis of what the book is about.
Great.
And this is one of those few books where really the title pretty much explains the book. It is about how different theories of international relations and foreign policy would handle a unanticipated occurrence, which would be what would happen if, in fact, the dead were starting to rise from the grave and tried to feast upon the living. So just to be clear, the kind of zombies we're talking about in this book are not your sort of Haitian voodoo zombies where they're like, you know, some sort of slave labor for a voodoo witch doctor. We're talking about these zombies from George Romero's Night of the Living Dead onward. And the book surveys a variety of theories, some well-known to foreign policy cognoscenti like realism or liberalism, others perhaps somewhat less well-known like social constructivism, and some that are known to foreign policy mavens but not necessarily international relations scholars like neoconservatism.
Yep, that sounds to be about the extent of it. And, you know, you touched on which zombies you were talking about and which zombies you weren't. And I think that's a good launching point. One of the things I wanted to start out with was, obviously, you're a political scientist, and this book is laid out in, I think, what a lot of people would recognize as traditional forms of a social sciences argument, beginning with defining the terms.
Right.
So flesh that out for me, so to speak.
Oh, right.
What you're talking about when you're talking about what we talk about when we talk about zombies.
What are we talking about when we talk about zombies? Well, you know, again, this is one of the crucial things in social science. You've got to make sure that everyone agrees on what we're saying when we talk about zombies. And there's some confusion here because, you know, the original zombies were, in fact, the Haitian kind of zombies where they were buried, some voodoo witch doctor resurrected them, and then they were at the beck and call of the witch doctor. Not talking about those zombies. There are basically three hard and fast rules that govern the kind of zombies that we're talking about. You know, consistent with the Zombie Research Society, I define a zombie as, you know, a reanimated being occupying a human host that craves human flesh. It doesn't have to be just brains. It can be all kinds of human flesh. I believe the three rules, it's been a while, but the three rules are, first, zombies desire human flesh. They do not desire to eat other zombies. This is important. The only thing they want to eat is human flesh. The second rule is that you cannot kill a zombie unless you destroy its brain. So shooting it anywhere else, chopping off limbs, what have you, none of that's going to do any good. You've got to get the brain. That's the only way, you know, the only way is to destroy the brain. And third, and this is most important, and in some ways the reason why we are concerned about zombies as a threat, if you are a human and you have been bitten by a zombie, you will inevitably become a zombie, I'm afraid. Zombie bites apparently have a 100% infection rate, which is quite startling compared to even, you know, really toxic and lethal viruses like Ebola. Even that only has something like a 50% infection rate. So really, zombieism is a virulent strain of disease that has to be combated at all turns.
Well, now not to be that guy, but to be perfectly honest, when I was a philosophy undergrad, I was that guy in the first row going, but teacher. One thing I've always been a little unclear on is, so a human getting bitten by a zombie becomes a zombie. However, the zombie wants your brains, and we've established that you take a zombie's head off and they die. So if a zombie feasts on a human's brains but engorges the entire brain, is there a chance that this is, you're just going to die, you're not going to become a zombie?
That is a fair point. So let me be clear. Okay, that's an excellent thing. First of all, I should point out that one of the fun things about doing this book was doing literature reviews to see who else, what other disciplines have talked about zombies. And I, as I'm sure you know, if you're a philosophy major, there is a big, big, you know, rage and debate in consciousness within the philosophy departments about whether or not a zombie could exist. Mm-hmm. Except their definition of a zombie is slightly different from my definition of a zombie. I think I got this correct in the book. Their definition of a zombie is a being like a human in every way except lacking consciousness, whereas I'm clearly defining as someone who likes brains. I think what you're talking about here is a situation where someone who's bitten by a zombie will inevitably become a zombie unless, of course, their brain is destroyed. Now, to be fair, here's where the definition is a little vague. I said that zombies want human flesh. The sort of popular conventional way of thinking about this is they just want brains, but they might just eat other aspects of the human body, in which case, if the brain stays intact, what's attached to that brain is going to become a zombie eventually.
Fair enough. I'm actually glad that you brought up the philosophical issue for a minute, though, because I was struck by one, I think, statistic in the book, which may have been actually a survey that you ran, on philosophers' beliefs vis-a-vis belief in zombies or the possibility of zombies versus
belief in God. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, that
was not a survey I ran. That was a Philo Papers survey that was run on professional philosophers. You know, asking them, would you believe in the existence of zombies? And, you know, I can't remember the exact, I don't want to misstate the actual numbers, but, you know, a majority of philosophers either thought that they were feasible or plausible. And these terms mean something slightly different in philosophy. What was interesting was if you compared that to whether or not they believed in God, the numbers fell to 15%.
If I recall, it went something from like 85% or something ridiculous like that to 15% believing in God.
Yeah, I believe it was something like 60 or 65. Hold on. Now I've got to open up the book, you know, and see exactly what the number is. Yep. 58% believe that zombies could exist on some level, as opposed to 15%. And so as I go on to point out in the book, you know, if we've got theology departments up the wazoo in universities, it seems somewhat churlish not to focus a little bit on zombies, given apparently the fact that philosophers believe they're much more likely to exist.
Fair enough.
That was one of those surveys from heaven when I read them. I was like, oh yes, thank you. I have my justification.
Yes, philosophers, give lots of, other social scientists hope with some of the interesting things that they've studied before. You brought up like kind of a review of the zombie literature, which of course is the next step in this academic sort of structure of, well, if I'm going to defend a thesis, let me talk about what's come before. So you did this in-depth review of the zombie lit, which was interesting to me because you also point out that you're not kind of native to this lit. It was almost like learning a new comparative study in another country because I think the extent of your horror watching was a bad experience with Poltergeist when you were a kid.
Yeah, as I said in the acknowledgments, you know, I was not a real horror movie maven growing up, and the first time I ever really like watched a horror movie for any extended period of time was Poltergeist, and just to be blunt, that scared the crap out of me, and you know, couldn't sleep that night, and so you know, avoided horror movies for a very, very long time, and I hadn't seen many zombie movies before I decided to write the book. I'd seen 28 Days Later, and I think I'd seen the remake of Dawn of the Dead and Shaun of the Dead, and that was pretty much it, to be honest. I mean, I had to watch all of Romero's movies. I'd seen Land of the Dead, but I hadn't seen any of the older ones. You know, hadn't seen, Return of the Living Dead or, Dead Alive, which is Peter Jackson's,
classic
contribution to the zombie genre. And sweet Jesus, easily the most disgusting movie ever made. It's really funny, but just so disgusting.
Anybody, I should say, just interject, anybody who, like, deifies the Lord of the Rings movies really owes it to themselves to go and find an unrated copy of that.
Yes, it should be an unrated copy. Because, really, what you see in that movie just defies belief. You know, it's you appreciate that Peter Jackson has a truly wicked sense of humor. And so, yeah, this was one of those experiences where not only did I have to, you know, watch all these zombie movies, really, I think the most perverse joy I got in this entire experience was the fact that I have a modest research account to fund research-related activities from Tufts, and I could justify the purchases of multiple DVDs of zombie movies because I had the advanced contract from Princeton University Press to write this book. So I made sure that the people at Tufts had the contract so they could see this. I wasn't just making this up. So I had to do that. I had not read World War Z before starting on this project. I hadn't read any other zombie book as well. So, So yeah, I really did have to get up to speed very fast.
Okay, so why, you know, you bring this up pretty nicely at one point in the book. We have, terrorism, pandemics, financial instability, cyber war. It's not like there isn't anything going on in the world right now. Why do we also have to worry about hypothetical flesh-eating undead?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think there's two reasons. The first is that the interesting thing about zombies is that they're clearly, you know, sort of culturally hot right now. You know, you take a look at any kind of research on output in terms of zombie movies, zombie books, The Walking Dead on television. Clearly, there's something going on that makes people interested in zombies right now, and so that in and of itself is kind of intrinsically interesting. Mm-hmm. Zombies, in that sense, you know, represent what former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld called the unknown unknowns in world politics. And in that sense, the great thing about this was, as I was doing the research for the book, it became really clear that depending upon the kind of zombies you're talking about, and there are different kinds of zombies, fast ones, slow ones, smart ones, dumb ones, and so forth, you know, zombies kind of represent the sort of constellation of 21st century threats that you just listed before. You know, traditionally, international relations has coped very well, done reasonably well sort of explaining state-to-state interactions. These theories don't necessarily, you know, think about how you deal with non-state actors. And so one of the interesting questions was, how well can they apply to things like zombies? And, you know, the way I always think about it is that if economists can develop models about widgets, which don't exist, it strikes me that the other social sciences should also be allowed to kind of play and be creative with ideas. And in some ways, thinking about zombies allows you to think, you know, in an out-of-the-box way about international relations. So in that sense, it was actually a really fun exercise for me.
Okay, so well, now you bring that up, how the different theories are going to deal with this zombie threat. And I want to get into that, but there's a lot to cover here. So I wonder if you can maybe sort of just encapsulize particularly the big – I think – the theories that most people are familiar with, even intuitively,
right,
are going to be realism, a liberalism, or pluralism of some sort. And, you know, I think we all know who neocons are at this point.
Yeah.
So maybe you can flesh out for me. Again, I got to really stop using that metaphor.
Adam, I got to warn you, as I said, one of the occupational hazards I discovered in writing about zombies, you can't escape puns.
Yeah.
I'm not really that big of a guy when it comes to puns. I'm not a real big fan of them. Writing this, it was impossible not to use them. You can't escape them.
I was going to say, clearly you were picking a lot of people's brains for suggestions. So, yeah, if you can just sort of hit the big theories really quickly and give a quick synopsis of how they deal with the zombie threat. And, I think for the layperson or even, you know, the well-initiated journalist, give us maybe a couple of real-life examples of diplomats or theorists that we can sort of hook up with these theories.
Sure. Well, all right, we'll start with realism. That's usually thought of as the oldest theory, you know, and the sort of default theory of international politics. The basic essence of realism is that realists believe that it is an anarchic world out there, and that's the fundamental fact of life in world politics. There is no world government. You know, it is a dog-eat-dog, or in case of zombies, man-eat-man kind of world out there. And as a result, you know, the primary actors for realists are states. And states in an anarchic environment have to, you know, can only rely on their own capabilities. They have to engage in what Ken Waltz referred to as self-help. So states have to rely on their own capabilities. They might ally with others temporarily, but these are usually alliances of convenience. Mm-hmm. Realists are profoundly skeptical about the ability of states to cooperate in an anarchic world. They usually believe that realists usually believe that states, you know, care about relative gain. So if there's any prospect for cooperation out there, states have to ask not just how much will I gain, but will I gain more than the other actor that I'm cooperating with? You know, prominent realists who are policymakers, Henry Kissinger is at this point, you know, thought of as your sort of ur-realist. Within the academy, people like Ken Waltz or John Mearsheimer would be thought of as your sort of standard realist.
Right.
You know, Richard Haass, who's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, I think would also usually be associated with the realist school. The realist school, when it comes to zombies, you know, if they're asking, you know, what would happen if the dead start rising from the grave, the realist answer to this would be, well, nothing that much would change. Now, this might sound surprising, but I should point out that realists usually give that answer to just about everything that has ever happened in the last two millennia. Realists never think the world has changed. That's one of the, you know, appealing aspects of realism. Realism basically thinks that if you go back to, you know, start with the Peloponnesian War of Athens and Sparta and go forward, these same dynamics of world politics play out over and over and over again. So to paraphrase Thucydides, you know, in a realist world, with zombies, the strong do what they can and the weak must be devoured by reanimated ravenous corpses. So realists would be very, very skeptical, about the ability of states to cooperate, in terms of combating the undead. Instead, they would be much more likely to suspect that the great powers would take advantage of the chaos created by zombies to kind of achieve their long, you know, desired goals, to augment their own capabilities. So to give a concrete example, China would probably be likely to say at some point that Taiwan was clearly infested with zombies and, you know, had to be dealt with, in a proper manner and had to be subdued. It would not be shocking if Russia did a similar thing with respect to either Belarus or Ukraine. And the United States, in all likelihood, would probably be sending the 82nd Airborne to Cuba if there was, in fact, a zombie infestation there. So as a result, you know, smaller states would be extremely wary of any kind of proposed global war on zombies. And indeed, realists over time would probably argue that the zombie state, the zombies would eventually also be subjected to the rigors of anarchy and would eventually adapt and evolve to the point where they would not look all that different from human governments. That zombie-led governments, you know, would roughly, you know, because the system is so confining, would have to also behave and engage in self-help in order to survive. So, you know, realists would probably posit that, you know, just as men have an innate lust for power, zombies have an innate lust for human flesh, and both of these things are scarce resources. So in this kind of world of scarcity, it you know, you would have a situation where eventually over time, zombie governments would not be all that different from human governments.
Okay, now let's talk about just very quickly the weaknesses on the realist perspective. It's interesting, I thought that you mentioned Mearsheimer's at University of Chicago earlier, because one of the things that one of the greatest hits I think that IR 101 theorist kids learn in their undergrad surveys is the stopping power of water, which is one of his famous lines. And I think a lot of people were very sardonic or critical about this idea that the United States, for example, being in a privileged geographical position, sort of had a privileged strategic position as a result because of what he called the stopping power of water, which a lot of people said was challenged after 9/11 when non-state actors flew planes into our buildings here between the oceans. How's the stopping power of water hold up against zombies?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, I think it was John Mearsheimer in Tragedy of Great Power Politics who talked a lot about the stopping power of water. You know, this basically, you know, we know from sort of two of the classic, you know, pieces of the zombie canon that, in fact, the stopping power of water would not be all that powerful when combating the undead. You know, from World War Z, an outstanding novel by Max Brooks, which I cite frequently in the book, you know, we know that zombies can exist underwater, in fact, indeed, have, like, moved underwater to get from point A to point B. And then also there's George Romero's Land of the Dead, and that in some ways is also some of the best evidence for the sort of realist argument that zombies would evolve over time, because by that movie, Romero had posited that the zombies were starting to learn, you know, how to develop coordinated attacks against humans, and one of the things they do at one point is cross one of the rivers in Pittsburgh, and they have no problem crossing it because zombies don't need to breathe underwater. And then there's also, of course, the Italian zombie genre of Antonio Fulci, where I believe there is that immortal footage of a zombie attacking a shark. So, in fact, there is very little stopping power of water in the zombie genre. And so as a result, in some ways, this further exacerbates the kind of realist fear that animates much of what they explain goes on in world politics. For realists, it's all about balancing against what they think the greatest threats are. I think the interesting question becomes, realists would probably also predict that eventually zombies would, you know, break up into different governments, and therefore you might have an instance where, in fact, zombies would also care about relative gains vis-a-vis other zombies. And if that were to happen, then I don't think the realist paradigm would change all that much. If, on the other hand, the zombies remain undivided, then I think the realist canon really starts to fall down here. Because that's just not something they would predict would happen. Mm-hmm. And in the end, you'd have to form a balancing coalition against that large, you know, ever-growing zombie horde.
Okay. So, we're running on pretty long here, so I want to do justice to some of the other theories. Obviously, one of the sort of false dichotomies I think it gets set up in, again, undergrads' minds is, okay, so there's realism and then there's liberalism or pluralism. So what's the flip side here? What is the liberal perspective on IR real quickly and how they deal with the zombies?
Okay, sorry, I'll move a little more quickly. The liberal paradigm, you know, accepts most of the realist, and here I'm talking about liberal institutionalism,
mm-hmm.
Basically, you know, represented by Bob Cohen in the academic world. Joe Nye would also often be associated with liberals. And, you know, a lot of people who, let's say, worked with the Clinton administration as well. Liberals, you know, acknowledge that the world is anarchic. They just think that cooperation is still possible in an anarchic world.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, things like multilateral institutions, economic interdependence, a world of democracies would sort of create the kind of trust necessary for states to cooperate and combat global problems such as climate change or, you know, pandemics or a rise of the undead. Now, the first strike against the liberal paradigm is that in some ways some of their policies would abet the spread of zombies. Since liberals believe in an open global economy, the open, you know, movement of people and goods and services and ideas across borders, this would obviously have to include the undead. So as a result, you know, probably a globalized world economy would also facilitate the spread, initial spread of the zombie plague. On the other hand, liberals would also argue that, you know, combating the undead is a serious and major public good. And therefore that you would see the creation of a global counter-zombie regime that would, you know, develop ways to regulate and prevent the spread of the undead.
Talking like an anti-zombie League of Nations or UN.
Or a World Zombie Organization, yes, mm-hmm. Something like that.
WZO.
You know, it might be within one single organization, or it might be an umbrella series of groups, you know, like climate change, which doesn't have a single international governmental organization. And, you know, liberals would predict that this would be an imperfect but nevertheless useful set of global governance structures. It would probably work extremely well in the advanced industrialized democracies. It would probably work in the developing world about as well as your typical UN peacekeeping mission, which is to say fair to Midland. You know, there would also be some holes in this. You know, liberals would acknowledge that authoritarian states, for example, might have an incentive to keep their zombie problem secret. Authoritarian states are usually loath to acknowledge that they have a health-related issue. Think about China and SARS back in 2003. Some developing countries might simply lack the capability to detect the zombie threat. And then, of course, we would have issues involving global civil society, which might protest the treatment of the undead and try to act in a way to promote undead rights going forward. So you'd likely see the creation of civil society groups like Zombies Without Borders, Zombie Rights Watch, People for the Ethical Treatment of Zombies, Zombaid, and so forth, that would, you know, certainly try to alter or modify the global counter-zombie regime.
So you could also see, for example, say say if there's a Middle East dictator who finds it in his interest to perpetuate the perception that he has a controlled zombie weapon of some sort or a zombie army, that if, for example, this international regime wants some more greater transparency, they want to see exactly what zombie capabilities he has, and he has an interest in not letting them in, you'd have sort of a rogue zombie state situation too.
Oh, well, even better than that would be an instance where you're trying to pressure, let's say, a government to alter its regime, and that, you know, the dictator would say, look, if you do that, the zombies will win. The zombies, you know, the zombies would take over, and I, you know, whatever stability you have in the region would be completely gone.
Mm-hmm.
So that would also be a problem that you know, the United States and other countries would potentially face in trying to foster reform in these kinds of countries.
Interesting. You mentioned Joseph Nye. I just wanted to sort of signpost him for people. You're talking about, for example, the author of Soft Power. So when we talk about liberalism, for example, we talk about a greater reliance on moral suasion of some of your greater powers in forming those.
I wouldn't say, I mean, liberals are perfectly fine with moral suasion, but in some ways I think constructivists, when we talk about them, would rely more on moral suasion.
Okay.
Liberals believe in carrots and sticks as well. They're much more skeptical, I think, about the use of force as a tool in a large swath of international relations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they are comfortable with material incentives and disincentives, absolutely.
Okay, here we are. So after we had a zombie blackout of our own, We are back with our brains. And I think we were just getting started into talking about some of the other theories that people kind of get a little fuzzy on behind realism and liberalism. Neocons are obviously the one that's, I think, everybody been on everybody's tips of their tongues for the last 10 years or so.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think this one's pretty easy, right? The neocons are clearly going to see any kind of a zombie threat as a threat to freedom, namely the freedom from having your brain sucked out.
Right.
And probably going to use it as a pretext to invade Iraq, right?
Well, as I said, that would be their first instinct. You know, if there's ever any problem, you invade Iraq. Yeah, you know, I said to their credit, I think neocons would recognize zombies as an existential threat, probably much earlier than some of the other paradigms. This is because neoconservatives recognize almost everything as an existential threat. You know, my favorite way of thinking about this is that if a neocon trips on the sidewalk, cracks in the sidewalk become an existential threat. So they would, you know, you're absolutely right, you know, argue that zombies hate us for our freedoms, not eat other people's brains. They would then posit that, you know, the only way to deal with the zombies is to have an aggressive, militarized response, attempting to shock and awe the zombies into non-existence. The problems, of course, with this kind of strategy is that the neocons would not be likely to stop with the zombies. They would posit that an axis of evil dead existed, in which clearly they would assume that the zombies must be in league with other American enemies, you know, including China, Russia, Iran, the EU, the United Nations, you know, Al Gore, you name it. You know, they would all be, you know, part of a single axis that would have to be combated.
Well, this brings up an interesting question. I think that both I and Charlie Carpenter, who's one of your colleagues, who's also an excellent blogger and international relations theorist, both sort of raised, which is you may have missed an opportunity to think outside the box here in terms of practical applications of zombie theories to, well, people who are technically living, but we might say kind of lack that consciousness component. Josh Rothman, who reviewed your book at Brainiac, actually brought this up. He said, are the IR theorists themselves zombies? Frameworks are so flexible that they can explain and accommodate any problem, no matter how outlandish or novel it is, like zombies. It seems to be the point. Today's foreign policy frameworks, outmoded as they may be, can still appear useful. They're the real walking dead. The example that I think Charlie and I both came up with is, come on, who is a better example of the walking, marching undead trying to suck whatever's left of your intellect other than neocons and their domestic base of support in the United States?
Well, okay, I'll push back a little bit on this, which is okay. In some ways you have to step back and think, what was the purpose? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, remember, I do work at Mother Jones, so I had to
get that in there. No, that was a perfectly valid question. I mean, in some ways, first of all, the approach I had with this was obviously to, you know, I mean, I was an equal opportunity mocker. I was trying to be in at least in writing this book. And I thought the only way you can do that properly is that you really do have to take the theories as they're presented by sort of their best proponents. And so in that sense, you know, the best way to mock is to love them at least at first or to at least, you know, to truly take them, you know, at their word. So, you know, on the neocon point, I mean, look, I don't deny that if you take a look at someone like John Bolton or someone like Sarah Palin, and by the way, you know, how do we know that Sarah Palin is actually eating a moose? You know, she says she likes moose. This is actually something I'm a little suspicious about. But, you know, let me put it this way. Those aren't the people that, you know, if you're trying to figure out what the intellectual roots of neoconservatism are, those aren't the people you go to. You know, you go to people like, you know, Francis Fukuyama, or Irving Kristol or Bob Kagan. And, you know, say what you will about these people. Brainless is not the word I would use to describe them.
Totally.
So I don't think that, that neocons necessarily, you know, are more automatons than, you know, than slavish, you know, adherence to any of these paradigms. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've met some realists that are that stone cold stupid as well. And I've met some pie-in-the-sky liberals that are equally, you know, out of touch, I think, with reality. So I don't know if this is unique to the neocons. The one way in which I think this was – this might be where teaching at a policy school, however, did affect which paradigms I included in the book. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, as you probably know, if you know anything about international relations theory, neoconservatism is not really a – there's not a lot of neocon professors or professors who, you know – make arguments in the neocon paradigm tradition. But again, as someone who teaches an apostasy school, I thought it was actually useful to have a theory in there that had actually been applied in practice. So, you know, it would be worthwhile to understand that.
Yeah. That brings up a couple of other interesting, directions I want to go. First of all, I think one of the reasons that neoconservatism has become so formidable, I actually think that when it was kind of a crystal Fukuyama formation, late in the Cold War and in the post-Cold War immediate era, that it didn't kind of have the American imagination that it did. And there was sort of adaptation after 9/11 because it was very domestically palatable. And the domestic popularity of some of these paradigms or the saleability of these paradigms is something that's not often explored in, as you say, like a non-policy or an academic atmosphere. So I just kind of want to lay that out there. I think we're going to talk a little bit later about first and second image theories.
I would phrase it a little bit different in the following sense. I think what happened in neoconservatism is that first, neocons had, the end of the Cold War was a really good moment for neoconservatives.
Sure.
Because one of their arguments was that democracy is really, a genuine force for good, and that an implacable, position vis-a-vis, authoritarian or totalitarian movements will actually yield results. So the neocon interpretation of the end of the Cold War was this was all about Reagan, standing firm and we're, the forces of history are with us and so on and so forth. Now it's very easy to poke some serious holes in that. Uh-huh. There's some small grain of truth, I think, to it, but not necessarily a lot of it. I think the advantage that neocons had right after 9/11 was that they were the theory that had the best off-the-shelf response, which is, if you remember, right after the crisis, everyone's trying to figure out how did this happen? Why is this going on?
Right.
And in some ways, I think both realists and liberals and sort of traditional IR paradigms were actually kind of gobsmacked. They didn't have a good response to this. The realist response to 9/11 is genuinely, it's not that big of a deal. Which is an easy thing to say 10 years later, but saying that in October of 2001 doesn't get you a lot of, political buy-in. Mm-hmm. So the neocons, on the other hand, had a great response, which was, this is World War IV. This is, an example of, people who hate us for our freedoms. Therefore, the way to stop this is to inject freedom in authoritarian despot states, and that will, solve the issue. And so that was, I think, intellectually appealing in a moment of genuine uncertainty. And that's in some ways when these paradigms matter most, when there's genuine radical uncertainty about what's going on.
Right.
That's when people will start looking to these kinds of ideas as kind of frameworks of what they should do going forward.
Well, given that you say that, sorry to cut you off, but given that you say that, do you think, if we look at the example that you fleshed out there of, sort of a latent, an overt explanation, a kind of a narrative that wraps around this cataclysmic event that we all experienced on 9/11, that's sort of still with us in, I don't want to be too cynical or reductive, but it's sort of with us in the form of like an Islamophobia or at least a concern about this otherness in our society. In that way, neocons could be a very seductive direction for future zombie policy, couldn't they? I mean, this would be probably the way that a lot of Americans might want to react, at least immediately, to a zombie threat.
No, I think that's absolutely right. The question, of course, is whether or not that's justified in the case of the zombies. I have to say, I was it was a little disturbing. I was talking to someone about the book, who shall remain nameless, and they asked me, well, come on, the zombies are just a metaphor for Muslims, right? And I was kind of appalled by that. But you're right. I mean, there's no question that in that sense that the neocons would have they've got a nice and ready narrative to offer to deal with the zombies in saying that it's an implacable foe. So in that sense, I would tend to agree with you.
Let's go with that for a sec. I think that's one of the weird things about this is that it is a cipher. Clearly, on some level, you don't mean it metaphorically, but obviously, if it has any instructive you know, abilities for us moving forward, hopefully it is something that we can apply to other real life situations.
Yeah.
Not to say zombieism isn't real life. It's certainly there in the possible ether. But, you know, I'm thinking as I'm reading through this, you know, who else we could sort of put into the zombies place to make it a useful theory. We've already talked about neocons as zombies, now Muslims as zombies. You know, other ones I was thinking about were, you know, can we apply zombie theory in non-zombie situations, like talking about something near and dear to your heart, Keynesian economists, monetarists, the Middle East protesters, for example. I mean, that would be a very cynical and kind of pro-statist thing to say, but when you look at the way that these state regimes kind of deal with the zombie threat that's gone on in Tunisia, then Egypt, now Algeria, possibly Yemen and Iran, you know, are we looking at something that's really analogous to the zombie outbreak?
Well, I would say two things on this. First, on the economic stuff, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, John Quiggin has written another book for Princeton University Press called Zombie Economics, in which he argues that in some ways we're currently experiencing the kind of zombie Washington consensus, which is to say that the policies and the economists are still promoting these policies, almost sort of ignorant of the 2008 crisis and the ways in which that crisis might suggest a rethinking of some of these ideas. At the same time, you know, Keynesianism has also had its moment in the sun in 2009, and now people are arguing that, you know, well, the results of that also haven't been terribly great. Ergo, you know, we need fresh brains to figure that out. So I do think zombieism, you know, the metaphor of zombies works pretty well to describe a lot of social phenomena. And this is why I think, you know, in the op-ed page in the New York Times, I think Maureen Dowd, Gail Collins, and Paul Krugman have all, you know, brought up the zombie metaphor in the last 6 months. So it allows them to play with their own ideas. To get to the Middle East, I think the Middle East, you know, what's happening in the Middle East and Tunisia and Egypt and elsewhere, this is actually in some ways a similar phenomenon to the zombie virus. It's just that in this case, it actually happens to be a virus that's a good thing. At least one will hope so, assuming that, you know, these transitions actually lead to some kind of semblance of democratic structures. It does demonstrate, though, the ways in which revolution in one country can actually spread to revolutions in other countries. You know, a month ago, everyone was asking, oh, Tunisia's happened, will it spread to Egypt? And you had a lot of realists arguing, no, it's never going to happen in Egypt. You know, you've got a strong authoritarian state structures there, never going to take place. And it turned out it took place. That's the good news. The bad news is that in some ways it succeeded in Egypt in the end, I think because the Egyptian military decided they weren't going to fire on their own citizens. Now, why they decided not to do that is an interesting question. It could be their own; they made that decision on their own. It could be that the U.S. leaned very heavily on the Egyptian military not to do that. We probably won't know the real story for quite some time. What'll be interesting is what happens in some of these other places, because in most of these other places, the U.S. has far less leverage. And so as a result, in a place like Algeria or a place certainly like Iran, the state might feel much less compunction about, you know, much less restraint in terms of killing these people. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm actually worried about in the Middle East going forward is whether you've got, you know, again, similar kind of uprisings, and whether these people hopefully will be smarter than zombies, because the governments are certainly going to be crueler, I think, than the governments in either Tunisia or Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was one of the other questions. You bring up two points here that I definitely want to drill down on. The first one being that the U.S. has not got equal leverage on a lot of these areas over there. And, you know, it raises the question in my mind whether if there were, for example, we'll take it back to the metaphor, the zombie threat arising in the Mideast raises the question whether U.S. or Western actors would have an incentive not to intervene. Unless, of course, it endangers Israel. But the reasoning there is not just a cynical, like, culling of perceived enemies, but also the very real possibility that a Western intervention in a Middle Eastern nation creates a backlash and brings about the exact situation that the West would seek to avoid. So would there be kind of a law of non-intervention there in that kind of a zombie threat?
You know, it's funny because I actually think one of the few movies I've seen that is actually a direct, you know, I mean, about as explicit a metaphor of the Iraq invasion as you're going to get is the sequel to 28 Days Later, 28 Weeks Later. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Sure.
But, you know, in that one, there's a U.S.-led force that reoccupies Great Britain after the rage virus has played itself out. And shockingly, it happens again. And you know, the U.S. Forces try to deal with it, and, you know, first discriminately, then indiscriminately. And in the end, it's just a massive failure. So, you know, to get to the actual cases of the Middle East, I think you're right that in some ways U.S. leverage over Egypt was probably much greater, you know, particularly because it all came down to the Egyptian military. And that in some ways was where U.S. leverage was at its most, most potent. I think the U.S. probably has some influence over Yemen, a little bit of influence over Algeria, but most of these other places, not so much. And as you say, you know, in some ways, you don't want to have too forceful an intervention because you don't want the perception that the U.S. is actually, you know, the veto player in these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be interesting to see going forward how the U.S. deals with a post-Mubarak Egypt if there actually is a democratic transition. Because let's face it, the U.S. is going to have about three decades, more than that, of, you know, being basically a pretty strong ally of an authoritarian Egyptian government. Now, there were good, I think, realpolitik reasons for doing that. But that said, you know, there are some legacy effects of that as a result. But on the other hand, I think the administration played this reasonably well because it did not have a strong hand to begin with, because it had a dictator that was, let's face it, somewhat out of touch. And most important, I think, from the U.S. perspective, I think part of what was explaining, you know, U.S. reluctance to get out in front of this is not Egypt. It's the other governments in the region. Which is, you might want this revolution to take place in Egypt. Do you want it to take place in Saudi Arabia then?
Right. And now just to run back to Egypt really quickly, because I think you touched on something that can lead us into the next step of the discussion, discussing really quickly, I think, social constructivism and some of the more newer, more innovative theories and constructs that are out there.
Right.
So you talked about how... if we're extending this metaphor of the zombies to, for example, the Egypt protests, the behavior of those protesters changed fundamentally when there was the change of power and the takeover by the military. Now, the military, I think most Americans are looking at this going, oh, great, they replaced one military originated ruler with a military junta, and we've got some reason to be skeptical. However, as you note, this did evoke a positive response from the protesters who were clamoring for Mubarak to go. And, you know, I think that got me thinking about constructivism, this idea that, you know, some of our assumptions that we hold very closely, particularly if we're realists, about anarchy or about power, can really be challenged, and human behavior can sort of be nudged in one direction or another.
Yeah.
So... maybe you can kind of encapsulate for me really quickly what the constructivist is going to say about the zombie threat.
Well, social constructivists are probably the newest, you know, sort of IR paradigm. And, you know, the key aspect that differentiates constructivists from, you know, either liberals or realists or other IR scholars is that constructivists believe that what matters is not so much material costs and benefits, but rather the ways that social structures interpret those costs and benefits. So, you know, in that sense, you know, constructivists stress the ways in which agency and identity are created by social structures and can be reconstituted by these social structures. So as a result, you know, for constructivists, the sort of most constraining element of world politics is not, you know, the use of force, it's rather social norms. And that actors don't want to be seen as, you know, violating or transgressing those norms, because then they're labeled as bad actors. So, you know, the most famous phrase in constructivism is from Alex Wendt's article, anarchy is what states make of it, meaning that, you know, they could, you know, if all states act as if, they think it's a Hobbesian, you know, dog-eat-dog world out there, then it becomes a dog-eat-dog world out there. But if all these states recognized there was a common threat or, you know, that there was a way in which they could join forces, you could have a pluralistic security community that would really, you know, be the first steps towards, you know, sort of a common set of governance structures. So in that sense, the constructivist, I think, would be relatively optimistic that, you know, obviously, as I said, you know, you can't resist the zombies or what humans make of them. And, you know, there would be the case could be made that states would interpret zombies as a way of creating this pluralistic security community as a way of combating the undead, and hopefully socializing the undead, such that you would teach them, you know, human norms and get them, even if they're still zombies biologically, to act as if they are human.
Okay, now, let me stop you right there. So you write this also elsewhere, socializing existing zombies into human society. Mm-hmm. It's a bold claim. Is there any kind of warrant in zombie lit for that claim?
Yes, actually there is. There's I think two sources. There's Day of the Dead, in which the most sympathetic zombie character ever put on film is a character named Bub. And there's a doctor that actually teaches Bub not to necessarily crave to eat him. To read, to speak, to salute, you know, to do basic tasks. So, you know, that suggests that there is a way in which you could socialize zombies into human norms. And the other example would be the very, very end of Shaun of the Dead, where you see, you know, after the zombie uprising has been quelled, you know, you start seeing these zombies, you know, they're on game shows, they're doing menial labor. And Sean's best friend, of course, plays with video games with it. So mm-hmm. there is some evidence for this in the zombie canon. I wouldn't have put it in the book otherwise.
So, and of course, there's also the possibility not to do apples and oranges here, but we have the vampire example of True Blood. Maybe we could also start to market in the capitalist paradigm a brain substitute.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. Yes, that's entirely possible. You know, maybe you can create artificial brains. You know, or brain sweeteners, you know, if you can come up with, you know, meat substitutes for vegans, then surely you should be able to come up with a brain substitute that satiates zombies.
Well, and that's the market, free market skeptic in me talking, and that sort of gets us into another area that Charlie Carpenter was talking about.
Yeah.
I think we both sort of lightly hit you on sure. the fact that she first hits me on saying that your book was in some form a postmodern critique of academia and pedagogy. Correctly, mm-hmm. because she totally caught me being a journalist using an academic term very carelessly. But I think the point still stands. Both of us kind of wanted to see more engagement with postmodern thinking here, and not, you know, in a very big umbrella sense. She listed critical theory, Marxist and feminist theories. In other words, I think you may have ticked off Ann Tickner. You know, I was also hoping for some kind of a Baudrillardian observation on, you know, the televised zombie invasion not taking place, some kind of a Neo-Matrix thing going on there. Charlie actually brought up a couple of your footnotes where you sort of made short shrift of feminist theory. Mm-hmm. And I think suggested that you were a little too wedded to some of these realist identifying terms, kind of suggesting a masculinized form of power. What do you say to critics like that?
Well, I'm willing to engage those critics, and I think I think Charlie raises some very trenchant points, and I need to wrestle with those significantly. I would say, you know, in my defense, a couple of things. The first is that, you know, this, and again, this is a hard material constraint. I had a word count with this book. You know, I couldn't deal with every single paradigm out there. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, you know, I think Charlie also mentioned in that post, and I have to admit this was something that occurred to me. You know, if this is a parody of, you know, how international relations, you know, goes about its business, then the proper place for feminism, Marxism, and critical theory was, in fact, to put it in the margins or in the footnotes. Because that's how frequently the mainstream discourse deals with it. So that's the glib response. The other response is that I was somewhat cautious about using those paradigms, in large part because as I was building up the book, you know, I was dealing with the paradigms that have been most prominently used. And this is, again, being at Fletcher, I think being at a policy school, you know, I was drawing on the ones that I know have actually been used in practice. You're harder pressed to find examples of, you know, feminist theory or Marxist theory actually being applied by states in modern world politics. So that was another issue that I had to cope with. And the third one, I think, and I say this with some trepidation, is that in some ways, you know, one of the joys I had with this book was the fact that I really did try to rip into every single paradigm that I analyzed. You know, sort of point out the ways in which, you know, the moment you introduce zombies, some of the assumptions that are made seem faintly absurd. I was reluctant to do that with feminism and with other approaches like that, precisely because in some ways, because these approaches have been more marginalized in the field, I didn't feel like, you know, doing that in this, I felt like doing that with those paradigms would have a different effect, I guess would be the way to put it.
Okay. No, I think that's very valid. I think I'm a little bit more cautious about your second criticism or your second argument there. It's just the idea that, well, you know, these are not much talked about in policy circles, I think is sort of a begging the question. Well, of course they're not. That's why we need to talk about them. But the point is well taken, and you know, certainly you can only have so much fun with what clearly is a robust topic in 114 or so pages.
Yeah, but it's an interesting point. I mean, let me put it this way. If I were to write a revived edition of this book, you know, and if it sells enough and you know, it's used for course adoption, it would be interesting to expand and add those chapters.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. So I want to talk about really quickly, you know, getting into a very similar argument. You also bring up towards the end bureaucratic and psychological factors at play in international relations. And this is sort of classified as a first and second image because we're now dealing with matters that are beneath the state level or the international level, you know, really more kind of smaller ontological units to steal from my philosophy professors.
Way to use ontological in the blogging heads, Adam. That's
thus ensuring that my first will be my last as well. But you know, you talk about the in the bureaucracy paradigm, sort of how decision making gets stovepiped and slowed down and just kind of log jammed in a governmental situation. And I thought this was telling because this is something as a national security reporter I find all the time. I just put up a video yesterday that we'll link to of the worst army gibberish ease, you know, public affairs video I've ever seen. The gist of which I think was, we'll find bin Laden as soon as we operationalize the net-centric battle space paradigm for optimal fires integration. And that got me thinking about the Battle of Yonkers. Tell me how that sort of rolled into your thinking.
Okay, well, for the uninitiated, the Battle of Yonkers is a feature of Max Brooks's outstanding novel, World War Z. And in some ways, I thought this was the moment where really the book sold me. This is the one book I recommend to people, even if they don't like zombies. This is still a good book, particularly if they have any interest whatsoever in international relations or comparative politics. In part because what Brooks is really doing is exploring how different states and different organizations, in fact, respond to the undead. And it's a very imaginative novel. The Battle of Yonkers, what happens, of course, is that it's a post-Iraq military dealing with the undead, and it's a disastrous battle because basically what they're doing is fighting the last battle. So they're desperately concerned that you know, the infantry has body armor, that they've dug in and they've got good, strong, solid positions. And, you know, the battle becomes a disaster because basically they never dealt with the idea that they're coping with zombies as opposed to insurgents. And so as a result, you know, they start going for the head, they're going for the center mass rather than the headshot. They're not like firing from, you know, elevated positions, which is, of course, the best way to deal with zombies because zombies don't climb terribly well. You know, they deploy large-scale artillery, but that doesn't really kill as many of them as they had anticipated. And in the end, the regular forces are overrun, and the rest of the book is all about how the military has to rethink how they're going to fight this war. Only in the end do they actually come up with the techniques in which they triumph. And in some ways, I thought that's actually why Brooks's book, I think, is my favorite, you know, movie and or book of these things, because what Brooks allowed, which Romero doesn't, for example, in his films, is the notion that human beings can adapt even better than zombies. Which is to say that, you know, in Romero's treatment, the zombies eventually figure out, you know, how to do things and how to break through, and humans are always feckless and selfish and they never cooperate. It's not that's not a bad argument, but, you know, as Brooks points out, humans and human organizations can learn to survive and thrive as well. And when put in crisis circumstances, they will eventually abandon old standard operating procedures and come up with new and innovative ways of dealing with things. So, again, writing this book, I actually wound up becoming much more optimistic about what would happen than I think the traditional zombie canon.
Yeah, I got that, and it certainly left an optimistic taste in my mouth. Not a taste for brains, for sure.
I understand. Yeah.
But you know, I think as we wrap up here, one of the things that we really need to talk about is what made this book possible. And you know, in many respects, IR theory is a subfield of a larger field, political sciences, of a culture, academia, that's always been fairly stodgy. And, you know...
Whatever do you mean, Adam? I don't understand.
Well, and you know, it's resistant to change, not unlike the military bureaucracy in the Battle of Yonkers.
Yep.
And, you know, this came about really because of some of your thinking out loud on a blog.
Yeah, this started off as a blog post, which I'm sure will be linked to. On the side, this started off as a blog post, and furthermore, this was inspired by a blogger. I've never done this publicly, but I really do need to thank Alex Massey from The Spectator, because it was his blog post that I initially saw that linked to this paper written by a bunch of Carleton University professors. And I read the paper, and then I riffed on what and the paper treated zombies as an epidemic and sort of modeled how they would spread, and I thought, well, there's no politics here. So I wrote this up as sort of a blog post and posted it, and it generated so much feedback, again, pardon the pun, that, you know, that was where I sort of had the idea, well, wait a minute, I should continue this. And in some ways, that's always been how I viewed the blog. The blog I always think of as kind of a nice intellectual, you know, sketch pad, in which, I come up with a variety of ideas. And, you know, I'd say 8 out of 10 of those ideas should crash and burn pretty badly. But every once in a while, something really interesting comes along and I can develop that into a longer policy article or even journal article.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess this is just one of the things that sort of amazes me is that obviously technology has enabled us to do things in the academic community that may have been unthinkable, and even if they were possible 10, 15 years ago, may have been a little taboo. Mm-hmm. I think about the fact that the interactions that I'm having on Twitter and blogging heads and all of these places with a couple of not only PhDs, not only ABDs, but or diplomats or people who are working in the field, but soldiers who are deployed, who can inject a much needed dose of realism in some of our more theoretical, lofty, you know, discussions. There's sort of a meeting of the minds on the internet that, in some ways, in a peer review world, may have been frowned upon before. Do you think that's changing?
I do, actually. Ironically, I've co-authored an essay with Charlie Carpenter on this very issue for a journal called International Studies Perspectives on basically how Web 2.0 technologies have changed the ways in which we as international relations scholars do what we do. So you're right that, you know, we all now have these online communities that are not necessarily just, you know, our fellow academics, but are also practitioners, you know, and people up and down the food chain in terms of, you know, where their status is in terms of the foreign policy community. So from sort of line soldiers all the way up to, you know, national security advisors, you know, it's remarkable how, you know, you can develop a new set of potentially peer reviewers to trot out ideas and to get them to respond to them. So, you know, in the case of the zombie thing, for example, I can tell you, for a matter of fact, I sent a copy because I was a request to a forward unit based in Spin Boldak, Afghanistan, because they've gotten really into zombies there, and so they wanted to take a look at the book. So I think one of the best treats I've gotten from this whole exercise was a photo that was sent back to me of these guys sitting on a Humvee reading the book.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, but I mean, I agree. So, you know, in some ways, these are new ways in which scholars are potentially getting their information, that it's not just an instance where, you know, you're only reading other peer-reviewed scholars, because, you know, that moves very, very slowly. So, and you're not just reading mainstream, you know, the New York Times or the Financial Times. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, my Twitter feed has wound up becoming an increasingly important part of my information diet. Now, I think there are downsides to this as well, potentially. So this isn't like a Pollyanna-ish claim that all is good here. I think there can be some down effects, and I think Cass Sunstein, among others, has talked about those. But it is interesting, and it's changing, and I think that's the reality, and I think that's something we need to think about a little more critically.
Yeah, and above and beyond, you know, just by way of finishing up, above and beyond, you know, the exchange of ideas, I think it's also an exchange of attitudes that's very nice. You know, let me hold up the book really quickly. International politics and zombies, people, for God's sakes, there are too many soldiers and diplomats and academics, I think, that are taking themselves and their ideas a little too seriously. And we need to inject a little bit of levity into this. John Bolton's mustache, if you can't have a sense of humor about that, I don't know what you're doing in this business. I think that's the great thing about this sort of meeting of the minds and these sorts of books. I will say, Dan, I'm going to go ahead and recommend this to my master's advisor at Florida State, Dr. Metcalf, if you're watching. IR and globalism classes kind of need this. I wish you much luck. And how do you follow up zombies? What's going to come next?
What's going to come next is I've got a book for Oxford University Press that I have to write about on the future of global governance. If I were to ever write another book like the zombie book, the joke I've got is that it would be called After Aliens, because Theories of International Politics is a play on Ken Waltz's very famous book, Theory of International Politics. The sort of response to Theory of International Politics was Bob Cohen's After Hegemony. Stephen Hawking, I think it was last year or the year before, said, for God's sakes, don't ever try to contact aliens, because if they come here, they'll just destroy our planet. And I thought, well, that would be an interesting follow-up, which is, you know, what can we draw from the sci-fi world to understand the proper planetary response to aliens?
Well, those of us whose eyelids have not been induced to drooping by you and me talking for an hour and are probably not halfway there to being zombies are going to anxiously await After Aliens. And until that moment comes, Dan Dresner from Tufts University, the author of Theories of International Politics and Zombies, thank you so much for sort of shedding some light on these issues. And we're looking forward to your future output, and we'll be reading you on foreignpolicy.com.
Adam, thanks a lot. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Dan.
All right, take care.
You too.
Ha 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 ha.